You're listening to the Professionally Insecure Podcast. Join hosts Jared Mariyama and Mark Morris as they explore the space between success and failure, perception and reality, and all the other junk floating around in our heads.
It's not a bunker. That's maybe, great. That's another thing we don't know about in California is space. I think we could touch our neighbors if we reach out of our windows most of the time, unless you're paying millions of dollars for real estate. So, yeah, I think that's the benefit of probably living anywhere but California or New York, I guess.
True.
Yeah. All right, let's jump into this. I am so happy to finally be talking to our guest today. Kristen Tursek is here joining us. You might know her better as Cuddly Rigor Mortis, and we will get into that just as soon as we can. But I'm very excited. I've met Kristen now. Was it just the once or was it a couple of times now?
I feel like we met, we did a couple of signings together, but they kind of blur together too. So it's like, I feel like, you know, all the underground people are at every signing, but that's not necessarily true.
That's right. Yeah, no, I know. It's a strange thing. So I want to jump right in because there's so much to talk about with what you've been doing since the beginning. And one of the most key things I want to talk about early on, especially, is that you went to film school. Is that right?
I did. I went to New York University.
Yeah.
And I specifically went for film and TV. And I had dreams of being a filmmaker, a director.
So, yeah, when you say filmmaker, though, was it strictly film? It wasn't animation per se, or was it like anything?
It wasn't animation when I started, but they have such a great animation department at NYU.
Right.
It slowly became the focus really of right. my studies there. So I did end up going into animation when I graduated.
Was there a specific film that made you want to pursue that as a career, or at least study it in college? Because that's I think it's one of the big decisions. Everyone's kind of a movie fan, I think, and everyone loves film kind of to a certain degree. But to make that decision to study it or to seek it out as a profession is a big sort of decision, I think, and not an easy one. What was there a film that made you say, like, okay, this is what I'm going to do?
Star Wars. The first one. I was 7 when I went to go see it. My brother and my dad, I'm not sure my mom came with us, but it just changed everything in my little brain.
Right.
I was already, I was artistic pretty early on and interested in creative things. And when I saw that on the screen, it just blew my little mind away, and I thought this is what I need to be involved in very quickly.
Right. And that's great.
Yeah, and
I think a whole generation of people felt that way.
Yes, yeah. I mean, absolutely, and I think it continues to at this point as well. But
I was
special
5.
Effects.
Yeah, for sure. It was unlike anything ever that's been, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I can't explain that or emphasize that enough for people who sort of grew up with Star Wars sort of in existence when they were born, as opposed to people like us who saw it, you know, out of the blue. We had no idea what it was going into it, nothing to compare it to. And what an impact that, because I think back to being 5 when I saw that, and I'm like, I know I didn't understand most of that, you know, like what the rebels were doing and what sort of this government, those aspects were. But I just loved this thing. And then it just, you know, then with Empire coming out as the second film, it's just even crazier. Like, oh, I thought I loved this thing and now I love this thing even more.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Same thing. It was a definite shift in culture, really, at that point, that it influenced everything and really formulated where my journey was going to go.
I know younger people Yeah, I no longer people like Mark kind of hate it when us old timers talk about Star Wars in this way. But it is certainly a club. And I think we're seeing that, especially now when we're sort of at this age where a lot of people are in their career, well into their careers, and can call back to something like Star Wars and saying how sort of influential it was. It was an exciting period in general, I think, in pop culture. Like the Muppets were starting then too, which was a huge influence on me as well. Again, something so different than anything we had seen before. And it was just such a big part of my childhood that I know I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today without those influences. Mark, so as the younger person here, what's your perspective on this? You saw Star Wars later, right?
VHS was how I was introduced to Star Wars. Yes. I actually remember, it's obviously different than your guys' experience, but I remember getting exposed to it for the first time. It's kind of like, it's so big in pop culture that it always kind of exists. Mm-hmm. And just for whatever reason, just like Superman, Spider-Man, like, you know, these characters in this world exist. But I remember specifically the first time I watched the trilogy. My dad, for whatever reason, got the VHS trilogy set. And just one weekend, I plowed through every single one. So it was like Friday night, Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning. And from that moment forward, it was just everything to me. I think I watched it like in September. And I made my dad do everything within his power to get me a Darth Vader Halloween costume to wear
by Halloween.
Yeah. By Halloween. And this was the days when, like, you couldn't go to the store and just get a Darth Vader costume off the shelves.
Yeah.
They had an insert in the VHSs, which had like a Star Wars catalog. And one of the things was a costume. And because I guess I complained and whined as kids do, I made him get like the expedited shipping to make sure that we would get it in time.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, that was my introduction to Star Wars.
Yeah, so I will not let this become a Star Wars show because I know we can easily do that. But so then you go to school for film with Star Wars as sort of inspiration. I'm sure there were tons of other films in there in the meantime.
Sure.
How do you transition then into animation from film?
While I was at Tisch School of the Arts, mm-hmm. at NYU, again, just looking through the different classes that you could take, and obviously animation was huge, and I was very interested in animation at that point because I wasn't going into NYU specifically for it, but it piqued my interest because the more I learned about making films, the less I realized it probably wasn't going to be the right path for me. I'm more of I like working by myself, and I saw a huge positive in animation. Not that animation can be done by yourself, but that I was able to really use my creativity much easier through via animation than I was in creating a live action film.
Right.
So I kind of slowly transitioned. And when I graduated, I specifically looked for animation jobs and this was 91.
And okay.
It was a little tough to find work at that point. It was a little bit of a drop, but somehow I found an animation job doing animating children's books, translating them into videos.
Wow, interesting.
Like two towns away from me in Jersey. And I thought, well, okay, it was through the paper at that point. It was an ad in the paper because there was no internet back then.
Right.
And no LinkedIn and, you know, and I answered the ad and that's how I started. And I didn't really again, it was interesting because I was very excited to animate, but again, once I got into it, it wasn't going to be the best thing for my head to animate as a I didn't feel like I was good enough to be able to animate to become a full-time animator.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably something, it's kind of like imposter syndrome, I think, where everybody feels like I can do it to this level, but I can't do it to this level, you know, until you're sort of, you push this way. Before we get off of school though, like you went to a very high profile school, obviously for film, no less. How was that process for you? Was it a tough, like critiques and things like that? Or were you able to sort of experiment and do the things you wanted to do?
NYU was very much, there were critiques, obviously. It didn't seem to be very intense. They did kind let us as students express ourselves a little bit more, I guess you could say, than rather than really giving us a lot of technical help with cameras and lights and setup. I mean, we had that, but the focus was more on creativity and making films.
Kind of a dark period, I would imagine, for film, like in general. When I was in college right around this time, and everything was very dark. Illustration was very dark. It was just a very like, and I couldn't have been more at odds with that, with my style. And here comes Mr. Happy Guy. And, you know, it was a big challenge for me, especially just in illustration, just to like try to emulate that style. It was a good sort of exercise for me to try to move out of my comfort zone. But the stuff that I did naturally was definitely sort of frowned upon or like, well, it's cute, but let's be serious here, you know. Did you feel any of that when you were doing, like, was your style, because you have a very playful style now that we see it here, were you at odds at all with any of that while you were doing college and sort of transitioning into animation?
No, because I was a very dark child.
That's great.
I have dealt with depression and anxiety since I was 9, maybe. Yeah, so some really dark stuff. And so my brain naturally went to dark places. And
interesting.
Creatively, very dark things. But I always had a sense of humor about it as well. So the playful side was always there.
Right.
And there was that contrast with, you know, just loving Goodfellas. Oh man, I wanted to make a movie like Goodfellas. Holy
right,
cow! Or,
right.
You know, just as an example, and so it wasn't. I was in love with it at the time, and I appreciated the darkness, I guess, for what it was. But it also became a way for me to deal with the depression and that I was dealing with at that point, because it wasn't really talked about too much at that point either.
I was just gonna say now. Yeah, for sure. There's not a very little awareness of it, and just sort of this general idea of like something's wrong, you know, like that kind of thing. But sort of empathy about it and everything. So we usually start this show off. The first question I usually ask is like, what kind of kid were you? And for some reason, this time I didn't do it. And yet now I got this. And this is so interesting. We can go into this as much as you want or don't want. But what kind of kid did that make you? Was that something that, were you a quieter kid because of the depression? Or were you aware that it was depression when you were young?
No. Mm-hmm. I just had a sense that something was, I internalized it a lot. It was more, you know, you can pull yourself up by yourself, and you should be able to, you know, go for a walk and work through it. And it became compounded because I felt like I should have had the strength to get past it.
Right.
Oh gosh, I'm sorry. I forgot the original question.
That's okay. No, just like, what kind of, did that make you sort of a quieter kid or more just an introspective kid or?
Yeah. I was always very, I have social anxiety too. So I never, I never really wanted to go out or be social or go to parties. That really wasn't my thing. So I had my own little world. And I mean, I was happy, but there was that underlying elephant in the room, I guess. That
right.
was mental illness, really.
Right.
Were you an art kid? It sounds like, you know, with art and creativity, it can kind of be a solo project. So did you kind of find that early on and spend a lot of time doing artwork and developing I don't know, your interest in that way?
Yes. I definitely was single. I was the artist very early on in school. First, second grade, teachers were picking me out, and I was the artist. I was the creative one. So that was my identifying factor pretty early on that I was artistic and creative, and I did spend a lot of time by myself.
Yeah.
Learning, teaching myself how to paint and sculpt and lots of different things, just, you know, to stay creative.
Interesting. So I had this whole notepad in front of me with all these questions, trying to formulate a timeline. This is always how I start. And now we're just going to go completely off the rails here.
Okay.
And I'm just going to ask you questions as they come up, because this is really interesting to me, because I relate a lot to what you're saying. I think a lot of art people have a similar backstory. Not everybody, of course, but I relate quite a bit to what you're saying here, and in that sort of spending a lot of time by yourself, getting the social anxiety. And I think I've learned to sort of deal with that stuff as an adult, but it's still there and I can still recognize it, or I can still feel that feeling, even though I'm able to manage it as an adult. I can still feel like, oh, this would have destroyed me as a, you know, as a kid, or as a, even in someone in high school or junior high school or something like that. How did you end up being so young and sort of feeling this way? How did you cope with that growing up? Was it something that you learned about later on? Is it something that you recognized more as an adult than you did at the time? Was there any coping mechanisms for you back then?
My coping mechanism, geez, what was it? going for long bike rides by myself and drawing and painting. And I didn't have a sense that anything was wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought everybody was this way.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it was my husband, after we were married, oh gosh, this was 90, it was probably about 97, 98, having a conversation with him. And I just mentioned in passing, well, you know, everybody thinks about killing themselves all the time, right? And he was like, holy moly, this is not the way the world works.
Right. Right.
And it was a huge revelation to me that not everyone thought that way.
Yeah.
And I could get help, and this was a real thing. It wasn't something that I was just going to go for a walk and be able to overcome this. Chemical levels in my brain. It just wasn't going to happen.
Right. That's amazing, right? That's what everyone would hope, I think, a partner or a spouse could do, right? Because I think when I hear this, I think about how much I'm in my head. And you don't even realize, I think, how much you're in your head until there's somebody else there that's either responding, or, you know, and it's someone that's kind of got to be there regularly. So they start seeing
patterns
or hearing what, you know, you drop things casually, like this assumption you said of, isn't everybody like this? And that's fantastic that someone is there to sort of to say that, to bounce something off like that, and then to promote you to get help or whatever you need like that. That's pretty amazing. You guys were sort of in business together early on. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. And you did the animation together?
Yes. I actually, he went to Parsons in the city. Oh,
wow.
And graduated in 92.
Yeah.
And I hired him at the animation company in Jersey.
Oh.
And it's a wonderful story about how he came to the interview. I won't regale you with that now, but it was just wonderful. And he was a great animator. And I hired him. And 9 months later, we fought like cats and dogs at the job. And later, we started dating. And 9 months after that, we started our company together, where we specifically did ink and paint, digital ink and paint for companies, for animation companies.
Oh, digital ink and paint. So there's your movie right there, right? That's a beautiful little, like, even just hearing that little bit, like the fighting at the beginning, that's like classic sitcom stuff there. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. How is it being married to another creative? It sounds fantastic from what you're telling me here in this story. It sounds like a fairy tale. Like, to me, for some reason, I've always had it in my head like I would kind of hate it. Like, I like that it's separate, that I don't have someone looking over my shoulder and saying like, are you sure about that blue? You know, because most of the time when people aren't in the industry, they just, you know, that looks great, right? That's the feedback you get. But how is it for you being married to a fellow creative?
I wouldn't change it for the world. I honestly couldn't think of it in my life being any other way other than being partnered up with Ed.
Yeah.
It's so, anything, any question you have or problem or layout or color or whatever, it we're there to bounce each other off each other. And mm-hmm. we brainstorm all the time. It's difficult to it's difficult for us to combine our creativity together into one piece. Mm-hmm. We've stayed pretty separate, but we're always sort of parallel with each other.
Right. Right.
So I love it. I think it's great.
So he does these very great felt creations. At least that's what I've seen on his website. I'm not sure beyond that, you know, but they're fantastic. And so then while you're doing this animation, you start going into designing your own plush. Was this like a hobby or was this something that you thought of as like, oh, this could be another venue for me?
It was totally a hobby. It totally started off as a hobby. The ink and paint business, we were working 7 days a week, like 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. and just over and over. We were doing anywhere from 7 to 10 projects at one time, trying to keep things in line. So it was very stressful for a mm-hmm. long time. And it just got to the point where we weren't doing anything else. And I thought, oh, it would be nice to have a hobby. And at that point, plush was starting to become popular. Mm-hmm. Friends With You started coming out with those crazy plushes, and everything just seemed so new and exciting. And I thought that I'm going to give that a shot.
And
it was, I had no sewing experience. No technical skill whatsoever. And for some reason I thought, I can do that. I'm going to do this. and pretty quickly it turned into a business. And that was the start of Cuddly Rigor Mortis.
Right. So were you working on staff with animation and then left to start your own animation company?
No, it was always, Ed and I always worked best on our own. We would occasionally get a couple, one or two people in to help us when we were really swamped, but it was really hard because we'd have to teach people the software. Right. It was pretty new at that point. So we just figured it was better to do it ourselves. And right at that point when I started doing the plush, we did kind of have a little bit more time to ourselves. So I was just sewing, in my spare time.
So, and then you just teach yourself to do this whole other career. That's that's pretty amazing. But it does sound consistent with everything you've sort of said so far, though, like about teaching yourself how to paint and sort of just following your interests, which I think is, it's great. It's a luxury to be able to do that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely is a luxury. And I am thankful every day that I have gotten this far doing pretty much what I want to do.
So isn't that amazing? Like I always think like young me would be thrilled to know that this is what I'm doing as an adult. I mean, there are certainly, you know, it's every day is not an easy day, but just when you look at the stuff that you're sort of fretting over, I'm like, well, I'd rather be worried about this stuff than anything else that, you know, that I can be. And I do always feel like it is a luxury to be able to do what I do. So then how do you make, is there a cutoff where you say, okay, no more animation, I'm going to just do either the plush, or as you start getting into the artwork and stuff like that? That must have been a big decision.
The ink and paint work started to slow down. I have notes as well because I have a terrible brain for dates. We were doing the ink and paint for SNL Saturday TV Funhouse.
Yeah.
In 2008, the writer's strike happened.
Right.
And they decided not to do the Saturday TV Funhouse anymore, the animation for SNL. And that was a huge chunk, a huge blow for our business. It was a definite step down in the amount of work that we were doing and the amount of money we were making. So
that must have been a crazy turnaround on those things, I'd imagine.
Oh boy. Yeah. our favorite story, because we worked, we are about an hour and a half, 40 minutes from New York City. And the animators would come down to our house and they'd sleep on the floor and we'd get stuff. And there was one, the closest we ever got to the deadline or airtime was we had a last minute change. I don't know that, you know, maybe it was like 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock on Saturday. And we had to drive the tapes into the city because at that point there was, you know, you couldn't upload files or anything very easily. So we drove the tapes into the city. And by the time we got back, we sat on the couch, turned on the TV, and it was the opening for the show. So there was some tight. Yeah, I can't even imagine actually working on the show full time. It was just this little piece that we were doing, and it was very stressful.
It's like crazy. The South Park stuff. It's that documentary they did. The turnarounds are so crazy. But it makes sense because SNL is so topical that I would imagine a lot of the ideas, even for the animation stuff, come so quick and they want to get it up right away.
Absolutely. It was amazing that the animators were able to get the scenes done, and we were able to put it all together in time every week.
Was this Ace and Gary?
Yeah, we did some Ace and Gary. Yeah.
That's so exciting. What a fun, it sounds grueling, but what a fun project to probably look back on as opposed to when you were in it.
Yes, we're actually friends with the animators now, whereas before, and when we sort of got started talking with them they came to some of my art shows, and they're like, we thought you hated us. It's like, no, we kind of hated the job, and it was so stressful. We loved you guys. So
yeah. So I'm going to ask sort of an indelicate question. They're working for something like SNL and NBC or whatever the structure was the money good? Was it appropriate to what you, it never is, but what did you think? Like, oh, okay, well, this is worth it.
Yeah, it was worth good. It. Yeah,
that's good to hear.
I won't go into details with that, but it was worth it. It was lucrative.
I would hope so. Yeah, that's good to hear. Sometimes, you know, people I think are surprised to hear when you work with these big clients that it's not always the most lucrative thing you're doing. It's the most high profile sometimes, but the money isn't always there. All right. I don't want to get off track here because this is why I want to talk to you. There's so many interesting facets to your career. And in the brief times that we've talked, I've known that there's so many great stories there. We'll probably have to do a second episode, but I want to move on to where you're doing your own paintings and stuff like that. Let's start with the name Cuddly Rigor Mortis. Where did that come from?
When I started, I had the idea to do the plush, mm-hmm. the plushes. And in the beginning, they were creepy cute. That's the term, creepy cute. So it was monsters and werewolves and things of that nature. So I wanted something that reflected that. And I had 5 pages of lines, notebook paper, just every line was a name for the business and me, the art.
Yeah.
And I couldn't come up with anything. And Ed comes strolling through the room and says, Cuddly Rigor Mortis. And I went, gosh darn it, you're right. that was the start of it. So Ed coined Cuddly Rigor Mortis, and it stuck. It just seemed appropriate, even when I've gotten out of the creepy aspect. It seems
You guys are truly a team. That's pretty amazing. Like, that's fantastic to hear. And that you even include that in the story. I bet a lot of people, like petty people like me, would probably say like, oh, well, we came up with it together. But you're so nice to give him full credit for that. That's really great. And then you start transitioning from plush into doing these paintings where obviously you can sort of do this a little bit faster. This is all coming from your bio here. which is interesting to me though. So you start painting more creatures that are similar to what you were doing in the plush. Is that right?
Correct. I felt a little restricted by the sewing because I wasn't really that good at it. I was working really long hours for not a lot of money. Again, that transition of, it would be good not to have to work so hard for so little money. Even though I had a following at that point.
Yeah.
And I went to a show. Ed was doing a show in LA at that point, and I met Mark Ryden. And he just inspired me so much, and I just absolutely loved him. And I was looking at the paintings on the gallery wall, and that old, because I hadn't painted in forever, and that wave came over me of I've got to paint again, and it was just a really definitive line in the sand where I did not want to sew anymore.
Yeah.
And I wanted to start painting. And I started with just recreating the characters that I had sewn and then quickly transitioned, realizing that I could do much more fantastical creatures and realistic things too. So,
yeah, Mark Ryden, fantastic artist. I'm very much inspired. it's one of those things, I think, where people think if you're inspired by someone, your work should look like that person's art. But, you know, like, I love what he does. And I think it's in some ways, I can see it, especially in your work, too, where you get that contrast between sort of the sweet and sort of this darker either world that they're in or just in the style. But just beautiful work. Juxtapose magazine was huge for me, too. It seems like a whole era that's gone, that we've left print and gone completely digital. And that makes sense. But I miss picking up those magazines and discovering new artists that way.
I swear to you, we were just talking about magazines and art magazines and going to Barnes & Noble or Borders and just perusing all the art magazines. It was wonderful. You know, there was that kind of little slice of time when that was where we got our inspiration from, and it was great.
So this is the old people talking again about pre-internet. You know, like, with everything being digital now, you kind of feel like whenever you want to see something, it'll be there. Whereas back then, I would clip out so much stuff, keep this morgue of images, just because, one, for reference, like if you needed a chair reference, there was nowhere to go. Like, you'd have to find a book or something. So I would keep these huge, like, boxes of images, and it was terribly organized, but just like that, like these I love this image. And so you'd have to buy the magazine and tear it out and tack it up or put it in a folder of things that you could pull out whenever you wanted to see them. And I think because it's like, I just have fond memories of that time and doing that, that I sort of miss that. Even though now when I see something digital, I'm like, oh, that's very cool. And then I kind of move on, you know, like, I'll be able to go back to their page another time and look. And I don't, but I just think in my head, well, it's there. I won't pull it and put it on my desktop or something like that. So yeah, such a different, it's kind of charming now when you look back on it, but.
That's true. Yeah.
That's so great. So then, you're painting now, and that sort of brings us to kind of where you are now. How long did it take you to sort of go fully into painting then and to start selling your paintings? Was that instant, or was that something you sort of built up to?
I was very lucky and started selling pretty quickly because I had such a lot of people were very angry with me when I transitioned from plush to painting. Which, you know, I guess I understand that to a certain degree, but a lot of people were fully on board with what I was doing and very, very quickly transitioned to into just being able to kind of sustain myself with painting alone.
That's amazing, because I think for so many artists and stuff like that, that's kind of the test, right? Can you do this as a way of making a living as opposed to just being a hobby or something like that? And I think when you're in it, that can be very stressful, and it can kind of, you know, for better or for worse, it can inform what we do to a certain degree, because you're thinking, well, this, I got to sell this thing, you know, eventually. Did you start off by just selling them yourself, or were you doing like gallery shows and things like that to sort of reach a wider audience?
I started off just selling them myself, online. I think LiveJournal was big at that point. This was 2009.
Okay.
And slowly, put a shop together, got a website together, and then I guess about, I got, started doing galleries maybe the next year.
Okay. So very
maybe
quick,
the
actually.
Next year. I had submitted Gallery Nucleus at that point had, they might still, it was a charity event where you submitted, you could submit artwork and they would sell it on their site, and you would say, okay, whatever percentage of the sale is going to go towards this charity. Mm-hmm. And I just said, I'm going to try it and see if they pick my artwork. And they did. And from that point, someone from Wonderground saw me at Gallery Nucleus. That's where I was scouted from. I got my first solo at Gallery 1988. They had seen me at Nucleus. So
yeah,
it really quickly transitioned into a lot. a lot of paintings.
So what would you say the span is there? Because I'm sure a lot of people who are getting started or something like that would probably want to know. Like, so you start painting and then now you're doing solo shows in Gallery 1988 and Wonderground and things that are getting sort of more high profile as you move along. What would you say that time span was?
I started painting 2009.
Okay.
2010 to 2011. I did exactly four paintings because I went through a major depression. Something I never experienced that bad before, and it was kind of all encompassing for Ed and I to take care of that and get through that. But from those four paintings, I got a show in Amsterdam. They had seen me online, scouting around.
They found you. Yeah.
And Wonderground happened in 2012. So it was kind of a quick, with such a major, I don't want to say the depression was a negative.
It was just part of it.
And that also was kind of a mental transition for me as well with my characters going, because I used to treat them really poorly.
What do you mean by that? If you can talk about that a little, what do you mean you treated them poorly? Like how you executed the artwork or just in your head?
The characters themselves were always straight mouth. They were never happy. They had X's for eyes. Most of the time they were missing an eye or an arm and obviously when I look back on it, it's like, my God. So the depression was really kind of, clamoring to get out at that point and wanted a voice and a way to kind of soothe my soul. And I was, I was kind of beating them up a little bit, putting these kind of sad little characters out there. And after the depression, I didn't want to have anything to do with that. And I started transitioning to that happy phase.
That's amazing. Oh, gosh. I love that story. I was going to ask you, and I will just go into this now, like about personal style and everything. And I don't think it can get any more personal than that. So with such a dramatic change then in sort of, mainly how you're thinking about your characters and your artwork and stuff like that. Did you also notice a change in your audience? Sort of like when you did a transition from plush to paintings, did people notice this? Did they respond? Because sometimes we can get a certain following that is attracted to that very thing that you were describing, sort of a Tim Burton-y, everybody's kind of a little broken, which is completely endearing and stuff like that. Did you notice a change in your audience?
Yes. There were some people who were a little upset with me. there were some people who were very upset with me. but those particular people I know are still fans today.
So
I was very lucky that people were up for the transition. They were a little upset, but those four paintings I did in 2010 are still big sellers for me, with the straight mouth and kind of the sad little characters. And occasionally I get someone who says, oh, I miss those. I wish you'd do more of those. But I just kind of kindly say, well, it's not really where I'm going right now. So
right. Exactly. That was then, right? That was a very specific period. With that much weight on a painting, on a series of paintings too, at such a key moment in your time, it must be weird to try to even think about, oh, I'm going to revisit that. I'm going to just recreate where I was in that space, because then everything feels sort of, I don't know, insincere or something like that to say like, okay, here's that thing you like,
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And it was a tough space to be in.
Right.
People might know my little meatball guy with the spaghetti on his head, kind of quintessential cuddly rigor mortis, and still one of my most popular pieces. And I cried the entire time I painted it So it's like, well, clearly I'm not, I don't want to harness that energy again, you know,
right.
I don't need to put myself back in that space just to get that type of artwork out of me again. So,
yeah. So then with social media being what it is nowadays and sort of with what you were just telling us, that do you feel how is that for you? Do you feel you have to sort of control? Like for me, it's very much a tool now. I'm more about how I can use it to show my work and sort of talk to my people and things like that, more so than just browsing to see what everybody's up to. And that sort of saved me, I think, a lot of sort of the things we hear about with social media. How is it for you? Do you have to control that? Is it just a tool, or like how does that work with you?
It is a tool. I don't have personal social media accounts. I don't have different circles where I will go and just talk to family and friends or something like that. It's if I didn't have to deal with social media at all, honestly, I wouldn't. It's really just a tool, like you had mentioned, to get my artwork to people and to get my artwork out to people.
Yeah, it's a crazy powerful tool. And I'm glad I didn't grow up with it. But to have it down, to use it for the way that we're using it, I think I'm like, well, I just couldn't. I think you can't not use it in that way. But it's sort of managing how, you know, when you wield that thing as opposed to sort of casually using it. We are quickly running out of time here, but there's a lot of things that I want to get to before we sort of go into our final questions. One of the most important things I wanted to ask you, and I get a sense of it from what we've been talking about here, what your answer might be, but as a woman working in the industry, and you're pretty solo, which is great, but you still have to kind of come in contact with clients and things like that. How has it been for you as a woman in the industry? Does it feel like a boys' club? Have there been any advantages or disadvantages that you've felt as you've kind of made your way through very different sections of your career?
It's interesting to think about that. I haven't really felt it directly.
Yeah.
But throughout my various careers, people will immediately think that I'm a man.
Interesting, really.
With working when we were doing Ink and Paint, I just went by Chris Tursak, and it was always interesting that transition when they spoke to me on the and Ed would usually field the calls, and so when they actually talked to me, they were very confused.
Yeah.
I didn't see any difference, but it was interesting that assumption was always made first. And the same thing happened to me when I started Cuddly, because I did not put out that I was a woman. It was, you know, it wasn't something that I consciously did. It was just kind of nice to have that little bit of space between me and the work, I guess. So I didn't put my name out there that much. And yeah. So many people thought that I was a dude, and I just kind of giggle at it a little bit. And, you know, if people persisted and asked me, it wasn't like I was hiding, but it was
right.
Very interesting that the audience would look at my art and just immediately assume that I was a man. So,
which speaks loads itself, right? That's the assumption, I think. That's interesting. But it's great that you didn't feel a lot of, I don't know, discrimination on that basis, or because you've been on your own for so long, it seems like that it seems like you can sort of manage a lot of like who you work with and how you work with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I feel like I've been in contact with a lot of women clients as well. Mm-hmm. So not on purpose. It just seems to work out that way. So I count myself lucky that I haven't been in a situation where I've had to confront or exist with that sort of
navigating.
Navigate. Good word.
That would be, I can't imagine. I mean, I it's one of those things that I didn't think about until more recently. When I look back, I'm like, yep, like in art school, it was mostly dudes. And, you know, if I had a job at a firm or an animation company where I'd have to go into the office, it's mostly guys, you know? And it just didn't occur to me how that could be just awful for a lot of people. You know, I did see it. There were times when you did see it and it was unfortunate and stuff like that. But I think, yeah, there's so much, it's better now that there's so much more of an awareness now around some of these issues. So one of the other things, I'm jumping around here and I hate to move on like from that as if we've covered that now. But I did want to talk to you specifically about Disney, and I know that must have introduced a whole new world of people to your work that sort of maybe didn't know about you before, didn't, you know, recognize your work as much. Was Disney, working for Disney, was that a goal of yours ever? Or was that just something sort of like this happy accident that happened?
Ed and I got married at Disney World.
Well, you did. Oh.
So needless to say, we are big fans, huge fans of Disney.
Yeah.
I didn't think that I would ever have an opportunity to work for them. I didn't know how it would work out, or it just didn't seem like it was even necessarily on my radar.
Yeah.
And when I got that email from Wonderground, crying, just like totally, totally blown away that this was something. And what I love is that they asked me if I would like to work for them. And I said, what? Who says no to that? I don't know.
Right.
So, it was always a huge source of inspiration for me. And, but I never thought in a million years that I would have been given that opportunity.
Yeah, that's fantastic to hear. I didn't know that there was the Disney in your past like that. That's great. I remember when I got the email, my first thought was suspicion. Like, I'm like, is this real? Like, and even as we proceeded with it, because they kept saying that, you know, they wanted your style, which was even more baffling, right? Because usually you think of Disney, you think of being like on the mark. Like, I'm like, I'm not going to be able to do this. I can't draw like that. And they kept saying like, Your style. We want your style. Like, this is too on model. Give us something that's a little more you. I was blown away by that.
I got the same thing from them too. There was one round of sketches I had given them, and I was so happy because they looked like Disney and I felt good about it. And they came back and they're like, no, we need you in there. We need you. And I was very confused, but it's nice. It was absolutely wonderful. It's wonderful to have that opportunity where you get to be you with Disney.
And it's such a high profile. Like, it doesn't get much higher profile than that. And so to have your stamp on these characters and have it in a gallery setting. Like, again, when we were contacted, there was no Wonderground before this. So it wasn't like we knew what this thing was and okay, we're going to gear it towards that. So it was like, it was flying blind, you know? And so I was terrified the whole time, but it was so exciting to finally, you know, see your stuff up in the gallery and have a good response. Like, with that, that was a dream come true, something I didn't ever thought would happen. So that's great. We are getting close to the end here, so I do want to touch base on one thing. Now, because you discussed the depression early on since you were a child, how are things now for you? You mentioned this period that you had sort of this turning point where you've had a bout of depression as well. Is it something that you're able to coexist with now and recognize earlier, or is it something that sort of plagues you day to day or year to year?
It is always there. It's always something that I'm under the care of a doctor for it. I'm on medication for it. I manage it. I try my best to do things that are positive for my mental health, not being overworked, not being incredibly stressed, meditating, trying, exercise is a little harder than meditating for me, but that's awesome too. But it will still rear its head and can be quite often. And it's just a matter of, you know, okay, let's look at this logically. And now I have the tools, and Ed's aware of what the signs are as well. So again, back to having an amazing understanding partner. He's like, well, if your arm was broken, you'd go to the doctor and you'd have a cast put on. So what's the difference? your brain is not functioning right. So you've got to be on some medication and you've got to take care of yourself. So
that's fantastic.
Very straightforward about it, which is not something that I was used to.
Do you feel like it's still an attitude of like, just pick yourself up, or just get over this kind of thing? Like, do you allow yourself now to sort of experience it?
Yes and no. When it can get bad, and when it does, my brain's a jerk. It lies to me. That was a huge thing to realize or learn was that my brain doesn't always tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm. And it's so very convincing, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you think, okay, so your brain is lying to you or being mean to you. And how do you get around that? It's a very delicate dance for me. So.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question now that we ask everybody, and everybody hates this question usually. But first I want to say, for people who want to try to get into Wonderground or to even do sort of what you do, where you're painting the things you want to paint and you're making a living out of that, what advice do you give to people who are starting out, whether that's personal style or just more of a business thing? Like, what advice do you get? I'm sure you get asked this all the time, and we all sort of hate this question because it's like, how do you wrap it up in 5 minutes? But what advice do you tend to give to start people that are starting out?
Don't do it.
But if you do,
there we go.
But if you do and you really want to, know that, oh boy, yeah, it's so hard.
Yeah,
it's so hard. I think being very motivated and energetic and positive, as positive as you can be, goes a long way. And I firmly believe that if you now with social media and the internet, you have a wonderful platform to be able to do just that. Put yourself out there and keep looking around, research galleries that you want to go be in, and what are some artists that you like and follow them. And I think it's kind of a mishmash of things, but it's not any one thing you can put your finger on. So that's about it.
My point of always asking this question is that there is no answer, but we will get asked that constantly, right? Or even parents asking, like, for your kid, like, I have a kid, he really loves to draw. What can you tell him? I don't know. Just keep doing it. Like, you know, like, I don't know. Like, and then as we get older, the advice becomes so general and, like, you know, not helpful. I know people want 5 steps to here's how you do it, you know, and it just doesn't work that way. Right.
Yeah. It really comes down to the person and what you want to put out there and I think a little bit of luck too. So
definitely luck. And, you certainly can't count on that. And I think the thing lately, I'm like, be sincere. Like absolutely. Just what I got from what you were talking about. Like, I think sometimes as artists, we are slaves to our passions or what we're doing. We can't help it. Like, this is the thing I'm doing right now, and I just got to do it, whether it's popular or not. And I think listening to that voice in your head and sort of trusting it after a while, it's difficult, but I think that's when you do your best work, is when you're really producing stuff from your heart and not saying, like, well, everyone's doing cats right now, so I'm going to do cats. You know, like, it's hard not to do that, especially with social media. But the follow-up to that question I want to ask is, because we talked about it so much, is I think mental health is something that a lot of artists struggle with and stuff like that. And to hear your story and to hear the success that you've had in spite of it, what advice do you give people that are sort of struggling, whatever the case may be, with a hard time right now or something like that? What advice do you give to those people to sort of coexist with those two things and yet still have a career and a fulfilling career? Is that a harder version of that same?
Yeah. I want to be thoughtful about it.
Sure.
I think professional help at a certain mm-hmm. point, realizing if you need professional help, get professional help. Therapy, yeah. Psychologist, psychiatrist, someone outside of a friend or family member at a certain yeah. point becomes... is something that is needed. Mm-hmm. It's not always the best to take it on by yourself or leave it to other people close to you to take care of it for you. Mm-hmm. And I think beyond that, be kind to yourself.
Yes.
Give yourself the leeway to not feel good all the time, and you don't need to be upbeat all the time, you don't need to be on point mm-hmm. all the time, but recognize that just being kind to yourself can go a long way, and just talking to people I think can go a long way too. That's something that I have a hard time doing. Mm-hmm. Is when I am starting to have a problem and I can recognize it, is opening up and
yeah.
and bringing it to light. And 9 times out of 10, when it's something, it's just starting and it's small and it's not overwhelming, it's a lot easier when you say it out loud, what's actually mm-hmm. going on inside our heads.
Be kind to yourself is such great advice. Do you personally employ any strategies that you found that have worked for you? Is that something that you, I'm sincerely interested in this now, because I think that's such a solution for so many people, especially artists who tend to be sort of feeling people, you know, so like a lot of things impact you regardless of what the reality is. So one lousy comment on social media might destroy you when you know it shouldn't, but it kind of does. So when you say be kind to yourself, are there things that you do on a daily basis or something to sort of remind yourself of that?
One of the things I started doing, which I've looked at for a long, long time, and I've been pretty, during the pandemic, being yeah. home all the time, I started meditating. With Headspace, yeah. actually, and it's mm-hmm. it's kind of changed how I frame my day. I started. It's really. I'm not super skilled at it. It doesn't always work, but like right before this, I was starting to feel overwhelmed, and I did a three minute breathing session, and I feel pretty good, you know. So I feel yeah. like I can do it now. So, I think meditation is huge. Kind of taking care of myself, making sure I get enough sleep.
Yeah.
Kind of really basic things that people don't always think about, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't get a good night's sleep, oof, it gets really dark up in my head.
It sort of, everything starts feeding into the other thing, right? So not enough mm-hmm. sleep, and then you're too busy, and then you're not eating right because you're too busy, and just everything sort of collides. Do you find that the voice in your head has changed over the years? Like it's nicer now that you're employing some of this stuff, or is it still sort of a struggle to overcome whatever that voice is saying to you? For me, it's like constant, nonstop, and it's something I have to sort of keep in check. But how's that for you? I think some people think when they see your success, they think, well, what do you have to complain about? You're doing great. Yeah. You know, like I think there's this sort of idea of that, but I find like a lot of that stuff just doesn't go away. It modifies and changes. So it's like, oh yeah, you did that, but what's next? So how is that voice in your head these days?
It is, it comes and goes. There are good yeah. days and there are not so great days. Mm-hmm. you know, 3 o'clock at night, it's a little louder in my head.
right.
As opposed to, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But
yeah,
it depends on the day for me. I can, mm-hmm. I have good days and great days, not too many great days, but,
right.
But it's just kind of something that I manage, and recognize it for what it is.
Right.
Which is just that not so great voice in the back of our heads.
Right. Yeah. That awful friend, right? That's either great or terrible. But they're always there. Yeah. They never go away. So yeah. I think like just that. It's like with everything, it's a process. It's an ongoing, never ending process. I think that's true like with art, you know, with what we do in our career, and it should be. I think the minute you're like on autopilot, then something's wrong. But the same with mental health. It's never that, oh, I was this way and now I'm better. It's just this constant flow of like exercise, right? You just got to keep doing it sort of daily or on some kind of routine to make sure you're keeping up. We normally do a series of 5 questions at the end of this. I'm going to skip it this time because it feels a little artificial at this point to go into some of this stuff. Like, this is great. This is exactly the kind of stuff that I want to talk about on this show. And I thank you so much for being so forthcoming with information. I wasn't expecting that. And it's great that you opened up. I think it can and help a lot of people. Do you have anything you want to promote right now that's coming up? Do you have a show or something, a release that's coming up anytime soon?
Maybe.
There you go.
I can't
That sounds
about.
Like a Disney artist to me.
Yeah. So maybe beginning of next year, you're going to see some stuff maybe from me.
Fantastic.
Right now it's just me.
There's a lot of maybes in there.
Yeah. That is like I said, it's a true Disney contractor talking right there. Whether it's a Disney project or not, I think we know how to sort of talk this way now, right?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And if people want to check out your work, if they don't already know it, where's the best place for them to go view your stuff?
CuddlyRigorMortis.com, and you can get, there's links there to all my social media and Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
And you have a store as well, right?
Yes, I have a shop. I have my own shop. I sell prints and magnets and originals too. I do originals.
What I love, what I just saw, not to go off on a tangent here, is you're doing this thing where you're sort of combining your painting with sort of a plushy feel to it, right? You've got these like fur collars around the faces. Which I just love. Is that like a new thing for you, or is this something that you've kind of been working on?
It just started. I was feeling really uninspired. Really uninspired. And I started just kind of cleaning out some draws, and I found my button draw from when I was doing plushes. So it's just just a ton of buttons. And I started getting plush ideas in my head, and I had some old fur lying around, and I'm like, let me see if I could just kind of put this together. And it just kind of came together. I'm not sure it's going to be an ongoing thing, but it's fun. It's fun for now.
Yeah, so it's a great sort of combination of sort of everything you do. Maybe that's your next thing, is this retrospective of all these different elements of your life. It's fantastic. Really cute. Really appealing stuff. I love what you do and the characters that you do. And so, you know, we do. I think there are similarities between our work, but yet so different. And I get excited whenever you do a new, whether it's a Disney piece or even more so when it's one of your own creations. So
thank you so much.
Please keep it up. And thank you so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate your time. Make sure you guys go and check out her work. It's really fun, beautiful stuff. Like, it's cute, but the painting is just really, I think that's one of the main things I love about your thing, is that the painting is really good. Like, it's
I really appreciate that.
It's this cute little item, but it's painted just you know, professionally and beautifully, and I just can't get it. Like, I end up staring at your things quite a while, like zooming in trying to see like the textures and everything like that. It's really great stuff. So yeah, go check it out if you aren't familiar with her work. And thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Thank you, guys. It was a blast. Thank you.
Great. I gotta say, of all the interviews we've done so far, that has been my favorite. And I can say that because we know the three other people that came before this one, and they won't take it personally.
It's dangerous for you to make such a bold statement.
My apologies to John, Liam, and Tommy. But I will say, though, I say that because I think this conversation is exactly the type of conversation I wanted to have on this show. Now, as you can probably tell from listening back to this, I wasn't quite prepared to discuss what we discussed. I'm so glad that she brought up issues of mental health, because I think it's something everybody, not just artists, that's restrictive, but everybody sort of struggles with this. But for her to be so forthcoming about it and to talk about it in the way that she did, I thought was surprising and nice and interesting.
It was refreshing to have somebody who has experienced all of these different mental health issues and is going to therapy so open about it. And I think she was doing that because she realized how important it is.
Absolutely.
To be candid about it, to not sort of shy away from that, but to share her story, basically.
It's interesting because it puts us in an interesting position of how to deal with that, and it made me a little nervous during it because I was very interested and I had a lot of questions, but I wanted to make sure I was respectful, not just going for what I was curious about, because I think I experienced a lot of the same thing she did, obviously in a very different way probably, but I could relate to a lot of what she was saying. And it just all of a sudden it occurred to me during that interview that I'm not a great interviewer. Like I have questions. I am naturally curious, I think, but it is very difficult to navigate something like that out of respect for the person who you're interviewing and also for your audience as well.
I feel like, so I'll give you a pass here, or I'll try and,
thank you. Generous. Okay. So
I feel like with our previous podcast, you know, the tone was very different.
Yeah.
And now that we're kind of getting into a little bit more serious territory, it's different kind of, interviewing in this arena, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's definitely more delicate topics, I guess. And depending on the guest and how comfortable they are speaking about certain things, it kind of goes back to us and how, like, it's uncomfortable to push them, even if they are comfortable doing it. So it's a weird sort of dance that I guess we'll just have to get more comfortable doing as we move forward. But yeah, I think this was a really good practice round, trying to do a little bit more of a serious interview as opposed to just something more conversational, like what we tend to do.
Right. I mean, it started off all geeky with Star Wars and we could have got stuck there for easily for 2 hours, but it quickly moved on. And I like that she wasn't hesitant. I think, like you said, she knew she wanted to discuss this on the show and she did, but she didn't tell us that beforehand, just so you guys know. So it wasn't like I had prepared my questions around that. So I was really pleased that she wanted to talk about it. Cause I did have a lot of questions and, God, a couple of times there, like when she was talking about how she was hard on her characters, like giving them little broken arms or sad faces, it almost like I started to tear up on my end and like try to like hold it together. It was so sweet, but it was so vulnerable in a way.
I really like that. You know, there's a lot of writers do this and other types of creatives who will create characters. They speak about them as if they are like real beings,
like pets or children or something, right?
It's because it is so personal, and with a lot of her characters, they're not IP,
right?
Like it's her characters creation coming out,
yeah,
so it is more personal, and it is sort of a, like she was saying, a reflection of her current state or whatever she's going through at the time. It's coming out in these characters, which is also really interesting.
Definitely. And I think that's the big difference between doing your own characters and doing IP, I think, because I'm always thinking like, well, what would, you know, Mickey Mouse do, or Donald Duck wouldn't do that. So I'm not going to do that. As opposed to just sort of creating a personality in your head. Sometimes people don't get the full story, but we tend to have like a backstory in our head. So yeah, that's very evident, I think, in her work.
I have a question with, so with your stuff, when you do your own characters, your brand is very cute, very happy, very playful. Do you feel like you're stuck having to produce something that is that very happy, very cute and kawaii? Like if you're ever feeling a certain way, like in her instance, you know, she had the broken characters because that's how she was feeling. Do you ever feel like you want to do that stuff, but you're kind of trapped in this kawaii world?
I get this question a lot. No, I don't feel trapped at all. Here's the thing. I like to do the contrast of stuff too. So I'm happy to include like other elements of it in the thing to sort of contrast the cuteness of everything. I just don't really do it too much. The work has been keeping me so busy that I don't have a lot of time to explore a lot of these other things. So a lot of the characters I create on my own tend to be iconic or sort of represent something, not so much me or my personality, but like Pumpkin Spice Boy, say, like it represents something else, right? And there's nothing, there's no emotion there for it other than he's cute and we all like pumpkin spice or something like that. So, but that is exactly what I want to have more time to do, is to be able to explore that, have characters that are a little bit more, I wouldn't say complex, that might be overstating it a bit, but certainly with a dimension to it. I think she does it really well in the work that she does when it's not Disney or something like that. Her Disney work is fantastic and her painting is wonderful, but her little characters that she does are just really great. And it's nice to know this about it. It kind of adds a dimension. Once you hear this interview, I think it sort of adds a dimension to it. And maybe you're going to look for things a little differently then, for better or for worse, I guess. But she's a great person. She's a nice person. I've met her a couple times. I just was excited that she was willing to do the show. So this was all just kind of out of the blue. And we did try to do this once before.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Has this ever happened before? So what, we scheduled an interview with her prior to the one you just listened to.
Yes.
And we were maybe only like 5, maybe 10 minutes in, and her screen froze, and then shortly after that just went black.
Yeah.
And apparently where she lives, they, even though it's summertime, they experience thunderstorms and severe weather. So apparently something went through and cut the power off, so she couldn't even get back online, and we had to, I'm hoping that what you just listened to doesn't feel like kind of awkward in the beginning, because I know at least for me, I was trying not to regurgitate some of the stuff we talked about before, or like force some of those answers if you liked something. But yeah, thinking about it, I don't know, has that ever happened? We've had people that get kicked off for like bad internet connection or something, but it usually we're able to restart it.
Yeah,
within the same evening.
I can't remember ever having to like where we stopped, like full stop like that. And, and on top of that, it was made worse by the fact of the timing of it all, because we were busy in that time. So we actually started to record this before the Tommy interview, and then we had to continue with our schedule to get the next episode out. So we had to actually kind of bumper almost a whole month, which was unfortunate. But I'm really glad that we did it, because I hope people, one, I hope people enjoy the episode. But two, I hope it can sort of set the standard for some of the other interviews to come, or to show that this is something we can talk about on the show, because I think it is a terribly uncomfortable topic to bring up, especially if you're she's not active on social media in that way where she's talking about every little thing that happens.
She touched on that too. It's very work focused, right? So it's all her own artwork, it's her own designs. I think at some point she shares her plush stuff. It's very work focused.
Yeah.
And that's the whole purpose of her social media.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say woke there for some reason. I'm like, oh, geez. So let's do takeaways real quick. But I got two takeaways here, and you can chime in on either one of these. The first one, the more serious one, I would say is that I like how she incorporates everything into her work. Not necessarily on purpose. You know, maybe it's in retrospect that she sees what happened, but that all of the things in your life, all of the events that take place are all part of what you do. It's not separate. It feeds into the other thing, and it can prevent you from working like she said it did for her, where she had some pauses in production or productivity. But that just makes her inspired for the next thing. Like, it all plays into it. It's not separate. You can't say like, oh, that's the personal side and this is the work side. I think it's impossible to do that. And so for better or for worse, who you are informs sort of what you do and what your output is. And you shouldn't fight it or try to hide it. I think it makes it more interesting. It makes it more personal. It makes it more you, and it makes it more unique in the end. And people won't always see exactly what they did. I don't think you'd look at her work and say, oh, this character sprung out of depression. Not at all. But there are things that little things that affect what she's doing. And I think that's great. Sure. And I think more people should sort of embrace that or be sort of conscious of that. The other thing, which I thought was really interesting, was that she's married to a creative. I think that really works for her. Like, I don't think it works for everybody, like it, yeah. But that sounds like a really great, when I heard that, then suddenly where my stance was, I wouldn't want to be married to a creative because I'm a baby about stuff. And if they said like, that looks a little weird, I'd be mad, you know? But they sound like such a team. And if their origin story is part of that too, though, I guess.
Right. I think so. I like being able to do the thing, the creative thing. And there's kind of like a little bit of mystery to how you do it.
Right.
If you're with a creative person and you do something, they could easily be like, oh, you kind of took a shortcut over here, didn't you? So I like that, just being able to like have that separation from the personal life and your professional life. And like, if you share something with your partner, you can, I don't know, you don't have to have those critiques like every single day, every moment. I don't know if I could do that either, having somebody doing like the same thing, or at least having the same sort of training there. I don't know how I would do with another creative.
I think that totally speaks to my insecurity as a creator in general. Just if they say it's great, you're like, okay, well, thank you. And if they say it's bad, you're like, well, you don't know. So like, there's no winning with that kind of thing for
right.
me. But boy, I think for her, you know, they did meet under professional circumstances, as she explained in the interview, which is great. And it's funny to hear that they fought or that they argued early on, and then that turned into dating.
So cute.
It is. It's totally a sitcom. So like, I'd probably get stuck in the argument part and never get to the dating like, part.
I can't stand this person. Yeah. And quit your job just to get away from them. One thing that I thought was really interesting was all of her sort of career turns. And it's interesting because it's still creative. So it's not like she's going to be an accountant and then go and be an illustrator. It's all under the creative umbrella. But it, you know, with so many different people who are in the creative field, they get known for a certain thing. So I was only familiar of her as an illustrator, but you could have easily been familiar with her work with a plush.
Animation.
And any one of these. Yeah, she did animation with the SNL stuff. She did stuff in the early 90s and then turned into her own company with her husband.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. To me, it's so interesting to see. Not only that you can have so many different careers, but so many different careers exist within the creative world. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know, even my short creative career has taken a lot of turns. But it's always fun and kind of refreshing to see what's available out there and the unique trail that different people take to get to where they're at today.
Yeah, because I think when you hear if you were to just see a list of stuff, it might look like she's bounced around a lot. But when I hear her story mm-hmm. and the way she tells it, everything just sort of led to the next thing.
Right.
Very naturally, and not in some force, like I've got to make some drastic change here or something like
and
that.
And it may not feel like that in her head, because I know for me, if I were to list all the things, like you could easily see how they're connected. But in my head, it's like a jumbled mess. You know?
I don't know about all the things, but yes, yes. I see what you mean. I think she's very thoughtful about everything. And I love that. Like, that's the kind of conversation I really, like I said, I do want to have on this show. And it's more interesting to me. It's really, for me, it's getting to sort of the personal stuff, not anything where it's like uncomfortable, but just where we're getting an understanding of someone and their work in a way that we wouldn't by just looking at them. Like we said before, so many of us talk about just like, oh, I work really hard and you know, versions of that. But it's interesting to hear that part of it. And I think we could have gone on and on a lot more. And I think I cut something short because I was so nervous and I was trying to be sort of conscious of time. We did talk about what it was like to be female in this field. And I don't know that I did that topic justice. I appreciate her answer. And I think it was a very honest answer. And I don't think there was a lot more to discuss there specifically. Mm-hmm. But it's something I definitely want to talk about more and fumble through that question. Like, as I'm asking those questions, I'm like, am I phrasing this right? Like, you know, like, does this sound awful? So stumbled a little like through that part. But
we were saying before, it's all kind of new territory and delicate topics that we're just not the best ones to be navigating. Especially, at least yet. Not yet.
Two dudes asking these questions like that. Like, all like it's a different language or something like that. But one of the other interesting things I did want to talk about quickly here was because she was so forthcoming, it made me want to sort of talk about some of my own stuff too a little bit. And I, the day that we actually recorded this interview, right about like an hour or two after that, I had my first therapy session, which I was really excited about. Like, I've been wanting to do therapy for a long time. I think my stance is everyone can use therapy. I think mm-hmm. a lot of people don't want therapy, but I think everyone can use it. And I'm not having a particularly difficult time or anything. This is something I've been thinking about just because of some big life changes that have happened over the past 3 years, maybe, just to sort of sort things out. So I did have my first session that same day. Yeah. So
what was the, if you don't mind sharing, what was the thing, if you say you've been thinking about it for a while, what's the thing that kind of pushed you to finally say, okay, I'm going to go through with this?
I think I've been thinking about this stuff a lot as we sort of transition out of quarantine, kind of, you know, like it's mm-hmm. still in this weird area. But then as I see, as we're sort of going back to kind of normal, but then pulling back, but then there's a lot of uncertainty right now, I think, about everything. So it just felt like everything sort of came to a head at this point. And like I said, it's not bad where it's like, oh, I can't get out of bed, but I don't want it to get to that point. And I haven't had anything like it where it's been that serious, but I would like to sort of straighten things out while I kind of have a perspective on it before I feel like it's something that has to be prescribed or something like that. So I don't know. Is therapy something you've ever thought about? I think everyone's thought about it.
I've been thinking about it. I'm similar to you for the past few years.
Yeah.
And my only, and I've gone so far as to like look up mm-hmm. specific therapists. And at the time when I had insurance, making sure that like the insurance was lined up and everything. So I made it pretty far, and for whatever reason, I'm still hesitant. And you know, it's scared that it's something new.
Yeah,
there's always been sort of a taboo around it, but I definitely think, like you said, everyone could probably benefit from it. And I'm hoping I'll get around to it sooner rather than later.
I mean, I think there's no point in doing it. I think it's like anything, like dieting or something like that. If you're not in the right headspace, if this is not something you want to do, I think it'll make everything harder or mm-hmm. you might not get the proper sort of response or why can't I think of any words anymore? Like the results, you won't get the results that you want if you're not going.
Well,
into
you
it.
Put, you get out of it what you put into it sort of a thing.
So my first session was very informational, just kind of like what's going on and like, you know, mm-hmm. kind of giving bio stuff to just say like this and the stuff. I will say it's very difficult to talk because of like doing these interviews and stuff, I almost started asking him questions, you know, like just because.
Well, I feel like in that scenario is probably more deflection. It's so uncomfortable that you've got to be talking about this thing. It's all you, but you're like, oh, what about you?
Yeah, I think I deflect naturally. Like, mm-hmm. and he didn't even mention this by the end of our conversation was that I think I punctuated every thing I mentioned. I would say, but really, it's not that bad. You know, like I would have to I would have to undercut everything by saying like, but I'm okay with it, and you know, I've thought about it and stuff. So it's almost like learning how to talk in that way, you know, like, cause you just naturally censor yourself, I think. And,
for sure.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, maybe not everybody, but for me, I certainly try to like, downplay everything and, just make it seem like it's not as big of a deal, but I'm excited. It's not, it's definitely not painful yet. Maybe it will be. He did bring up a few things where I'm like, oh, I didn't think we were going to go in that direction. So we'll see what happens. I will share what I feel like sharing as it comes up. But we'll see. Yeah. It has a potential, obviously, to get kind of.
Maybe kinda this crazy. Will, you'll be the push to get me to do it.
Yeah.
We'll see. I'll react based on off of your reaction.
I think the hardest thing is finding someone, but I think you just have to start. Like, you know, like, yeah. And that's what's crazy and expensive about it. It's like, you don't want to go 5 sessions and be like, I think I'm going to go somewhere else with all my luggage. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll keep updating as that happens. We're going to do it like once a week for a while. I'm like, eesh, that's a lot.
Well, I'm excited that you're doing this. I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
And I hope it'll rub off on me eventually.
I don't think so, but yeah, yeah. So again, thank you to Kristen for doing the interview. Really appreciate her coming on. If you guys have any further questions for her, like all our other guests, I say reach out to them directly because they are all decent people. But if you have something that you want us to ask or to talk about on the show, let us know. And Mark, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can send us an email to podcast@squaredcoaststudios.com. And it's, doesn't have to be specific to a guest. Like Jared said, it can be. We can try and help you get an answer, but Jared and I will be reading these as they come in and try and help you out the best we can. So
yeah.
Any questions, please send them to us at podcast@squaredcoaststudios.com. And it doesn't have to be questions either. We praise us. We love to receive some praise emails. That's always, always welcome.
Yes. I get a lot of questions that have nothing to do with necessarily the topic. But like sometimes people will just casually drop something and they will ask it. I had some people ask about Mark's Chippendale audition. So there you go.
Fun.
Yeah. So who knows? If we get those kind of questions, I'm sure he'll be happy to answer those. So
I'll screen them and delete them as if they never existed.
But please, we would love to do more interaction like that with the people who do listen, because that's so much more fun. And yeah, so please
do. Did I share that on an episode?
Yes, you did. Remember we talked about the song?
No, I don't remember.
Imagine Dragons, I believe.
Yeah, I know I told you that, but...
Yes, this person would
the lines are getting blurred.
It was when John talked about his almost doing it.
Oh, yeah. Fun.
Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. And we will be back again shortly with another guest and more cringy stories.
Would you like to ask Jared or Mark a question? Are you interested in advertising or sponsoring the show? Then send an email to podcast@squaredcoaststudios.com. Professionally Insecure is a Squared Coast Studios production. This episode was produced and edited by Mark Morris, with additional audio support from Sean Keenan.